Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the newest episode of Unredacted with myself, Glenn Greenwald, and my co-host Q, who has just arrived. Are you there? Yes, you are.
Hello.
Hey, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine. Can you hear me?
I can hear you as well. First of all, how are you doing?
Is this the first time that we've actually started the show, first of all, on time and that both of our microphones are working and we could hear each other?
Yes, although we still have not yet had an episode where you arrived prior to my arrival.
I did beat
you by several seconds, which is a goal of mine to continue that streak and never let you get here first.
Give me a break. I was the one that hit the go live button. Or did you hit the go live button?
No, I did too. Okay, we must have both hit it together. And I just, my phone pushed me up more quickly. Everything good on your end?
Yeah. You know, your boy got married. She finally made me an honest man. Wait a second. We already talked about this.
We did. I believe the room is up to date on your matrimonial
list. Listen, that was in such a fog after the holidays that I can barely remember anything I said. Let's see what else is new. Nothing really. I've just been, you know, hard at work on these Colin-related projects.
We did pick three pretty broad topics. And for people who don't know, whose first time is today for being on a Colin show, the idea is that it's interactive. So if you have a question at any time, including now, you can hit the raise hand feature and you'll be put into the queue, and we'll do our best to save as much time as we can at the end for questions and answers about with the three topics we chose to talk about, and we'll try and kind of zip through them. But before we do, I was just kind of reveling in the extraordinary and seemingly endless failures of the Biden administration. Just like in the past 24 hours alone, they had record high inflation, the most since 1982, which you can quibble with in terms of the statistical significance and the like, but clearly it's something on people's minds, and it's not a good thing that prices continue to increase for most people. There was a poll released yesterday that's generally favorable to Democrats from Quinnipiac, showing Biden's approval rating cratering at 33%. Extremely unpopular among young people, Hispanics, independents, pretty much across the board.
Wonder how we could have avoided all that. And by the way, just want to point out that Bush's approval rating near the end of his presidency after the financial collapse was about the same, about 33%.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Trump's approval rating after his first year with all of the Russiagate stuff and all of the various scandals, top aides indicted in the same Quinnipiac poll was 38%. And even more alarming for the Democrats, Trump's approval rating on the economy, which obviously is the most important issue generally, it was 48% at this time, and Biden's is 34%. So it's a 14-point gap. And then today, both Manchin and Sinema completely brushed off Biden's urgency of now speech that he flew to Atlanta flamboyantly to deliver about the need to lift the filibuster, both saying that they would refuse to budge and will continue to support the filibuster. And then just an hour ago or so, the Supreme Court, by a 6-3 vote, ruled unconstitutional the part of Biden's vaccine mandate imposed for large employers. It's just like managerial competence type failure after the next.
Yeah, I saw the article in the Washington Post today when the Supreme Court struck down vaccine requirements at workplaces. And I mean, this is something that both you and I, you know, for all of our differences, said the exact same thing, that this was bound to happen. Once you restrict people's freedom of mobility and you start placing barriers between them and being able to earn a living, you've now got some legal and possibly constitutional, or in Canada, charter problems to deal with. So it's not surprising to me that it was blocked by the Supreme Court, especially given its more conservative bent. Not that I think that it is a conservative position, but I find that I find that conservative justices, and I know I'm going out on a limb here, but I feel like I've got enough ammo to back me up on this one, that when it comes to matters of civil liberties, there are certain kinds of civil liberties that you will find that progressive federal judges value, and other kinds that conservative judges value. And I think where it comes to a matter of people's ability to move about freely and to engage in whatever kind of employment they want, not to say that they're that interested in fair labor laws, but what they are more interested in is, for example, if you want to go work in a workplace that has been unionized and there's a question of whether it's going to break the spirit of comity between employers and unions, if you decide to go and work there, I find that federal judges are sympathetic to the employers, that they'll want somebody to be able to go into a workplace even if it's not unionized or if there has been past unionization. So I kind of find that it falls along the same lines, where people don't want to have to show that they've been vaccinated to go to work. And, you know, Chief Justice John Roberts, Brett Kavanaugh, were essentially in the majority, and they said, no, absolutely, there is no reason that you should have to show your proof of vaccination in order to simply go to work.
I hope I got that right, because I know I'm dealing
with a strong legal mind here, and I want to make sure that I'm dotting
off. You are with a very experienced constitutional lawyer. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, the case itself, like, legally fell on a pretty narrow and simple question, which is, do you need the Congress to impose a vaccine mandate, or can the president simply impose it unilaterally? Obviously, everyone agrees that if Congress wants to make a vaccine mandate, they can tomorrow enact one and require that employers demand of their employees proof of vaccination or a test or else be fired. So it was a kind of narrow ruling in the sense that all they said was the president and the Department of Labor, under the laws enacted by Congress to provide for a safe workplace, don't allow this level of intrusion. If it needs to be done, it has to be done by Congress. But it does actually relate to a lot of what you and I have been talking about with COVID, because the court basically recognized the lie that was at the heart of Biden's decree, which was he was claiming that these vaccine mandates are necessary to keep people safe in the workplace. And that is based on what is now clearly the falsehood that people who are vaccinated are not a threat to transmit the disease. Only people who are unvaccinated are. And so the court said, this is clearly not about workplace safety. This is about trying to cajole the population into doing something. What's that?
That it's about coercion. And what Justice Roberts pointed to was the discrepancy between what the Biden administration said it wanted to do and the way that the policy was actually implemented. So, for example, pointing to the Secretary of Labor estimating that 9% of landscapers and groundskeepers qualify as working exclusively outside, right? So when they say that, you know, there's narrow exemptions for employees that work remotely 100% of the time or who work exclusively outdoors, saying that, well, those exemptions are, I mean, they may as well not even exist. And it doesn't draw very strong distinctions. So while you can sell this idea to the public and say, well, we have created provisions around which people who simply have to work within, let's say, isolated environments or environments where they're not at high risk of transmitting to their coworkers, unfortunately, it doesn't bear out that way when you look at what people's actual workplace life looks like, which is what Justice Roberts, I think, looked at here, and disagreeing with lower courts, was able to make that distinction. And I was saying that from the very beginning, that there are very few cases in which the United States has been able to enforce any such thing as a vaccine mandate. And in the majority of instances, when they do that, it ends atrociously.
You know, I think one thing that's so interesting is the way the politics plays out in the U.S. versus elsewhere. So, you know, you referenced earlier that the propensity of courts to protect employers, which definitely is true. But in a lot of, I think much more so, when it comes to this question of vaccine mandates, it's really actually a question of workers. That may not have been what was on the mind of the majority of justices, but the people who suffer most are the people who lose their jobs if they choose not to get vaccinated.
Right.
And that's why
or
I find it
unable
so,
to.
Yeah, well, if you're unable, you can show a you can get a medical exemption.
No, no. When I say unable to, I mean unable as in perhaps there are only X amount of clinics in your region. You don't have a car. You weren't able to get out to the clinic to get vaccinated, that sort of thing.
Right. Right. So let's say unable or...
To draw a distinction between like people who are rigidly anti-vax and people who are hesitant and people who are willing to get the vaccine, but there are any number of structural obstacles in the way of that happening.
Right. I agree with that, those distinctions. I mean, I questioned how much at this point of the percentages are allocated to each category, but certainly it's a non-trivial percentage
well,
of people who have
why
some impediment.
Why don't we have an answer to that question? You brought up Quinnipiac polling, right? That organization, along with everyone from Gallup to Politico, there are so many polling organizations that exist for the express purpose of figuring out how exactly can this political party, like, just ease up its percentage share of the voting population so that they can capture a majority in Congress, the Senate, local races, et cetera. And they're able to, with a very finite amount of precision, ask the questions in such a way that they can actually get to what it is that people didn't even know that they're missing from the local politicians. So if they're able to do that in service of getting people elected to public office, why when somewhere between, depending on where in America you go, you know, you're looking at anywhere between 10 and 20% of the population that hasn't gotten vaccinated, why is there no polling to ask, hey, what is in the way of you actually getting vaccinated? I shouldn't say no polling, but why is there so little polling to ask, okay, so what's stopping you from getting vaccinated and what would make you change your mind?
Yeah, I mean, there's been some surveying, but not really polling data. You know, the narrative that, oh, it's all MAGA people clearly falls under minimal scrutiny when you look at the large number of minority voters in large blue state cities who are still unvaccinated. They've made clear their cause for vaccine hesitancy or even vaccine reluctance. But the interesting thing politically to me is if you look at how the politics of the question have played out in the UK, Boris Johnson last month demanded and the Tory party overwhelmingly supported the imposition of both vaccine mandates and vaccine passports, a measure that was opposed both by Jeremy Corbyn and the largest labor unions, including the largest labor union that represented healthcare workers, on the grounds that it's an infringement of labor rights to force people to be vaccinated in order to keep their job. The leftist candidate in France, the leftist presidential candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, also is vehemently opposed to vaccine mandates, has been hammering Macron about his efforts to try and coerce people to get vaccinated. It's always interesting to me that in the U.S. we tend to talk about, and I think in Canada it's been like this too, this kind of collective duty that we all have that the government is acting in the public health, whereas in the U.K. and in France, at least significant parts of the actual left are viewing
America.
This as kind of like from an anti-authoritarian prism.
Yeah, no, it's the same thing in Latin America. I was talking to a friend of mine that is a journalist in South America, and she told me the same thing, that many people in Latin American countries are, I wouldn't say like anti-vax, but are suspicious of big pharma and very suspicious of the vaccine mandates, highly against them, in fact, are suspicious of mask mandates, et cetera. And while I'm not going to say whether I agree with it one way or the other, I mean, I don't live there. I don't exist under the same conditions. So they probably have reasons for having these kinds of oppositions that I'm not privy to in my life and context. But at the same time, like I have a fairly skeptical approach to any law or any regulation or emergency order that's going to restrict people's ability to move about, restrict people's ability to earn a living, restrict people's ability to keep roof over their heads. And what I'm finding is as this drags out longer and longer, people aren't looking towards government. I mean, they are in the sense that like, they're like, you know, government's failing all of us, but I find there's just a lot more vitriol. There's a lot more anger for fellow people. For those of us, anywhere between 10 and 20%, depending on where you go, saying if it wasn't for these fuckers, we'd be out of this pandemic already. And I wonder to what extent that's people basically throwing their hands up and saying, I am completely powerless. I am impotent. I can't change anything about the world around me. The only thing that I can do is take out my anger and vent my frustration on the people whose feelings that I can hurt.
You know, I find that like at the heart of so much of my concern and dissatisfaction and frustration with political debates and recent political developments, not just that the citizenry is being encouraged with increasing success to vent their frustration at one another as opposed to the ruling class or elites. There's some of that, but I mean, increasingly it's at our fellow citizens who have different ideologies or we're told different cultural affinities or whatever. But the media, even more so, seems very trained on stigmatizing and ostracizing and punishing off-key citizens as opposed to holding institutions of power accountable.
Right.
And it just seems like there's a much more concerted effort than ever before to impose this kind of submission to orthodoxy. And the COVID pandemic has been the perfect vehicle to justify it, because when you make people afraid of their health and their children's health and their parents' health, you're going to put them into a state of increased acquiescence.
Yeah. I mean, we can go back and forth on this, and I know exactly how this conversation will end. We'll both, you know, just be mad at the system and encourage people to be a lot more kind and understanding with their fellow citizens. But I think one thing that's missing in all this is we haven't asked. There's been, you know, these theories about the Wuhan lab leak. There's been theories about it having a crossover from animals to humans. There's any number of theories as to how this disease first infected human beings. The one thing that I think that we haven't really examined, at least in from a mainstream sense, is why are these federal agencies conducting experiments in this sort of testing alongside other states? Why are they partnering up? I see that there's like a rush to blame Chinese labs, but those labs were working in partnership with the U.S. government. So is there a question to be asked about why it is that this sort of testing is taking place to begin with? And second, to what extent can we hold our governments accountable for failures to properly respond to this crisis? I see that in the sense that, like, there are many, there's many policy levers that are available to be pulled that simply aren't being pulled. Like, there's many measures that can be taken. The federal government, both in the United States and Canada, wants to act like the cupboard is bare, but the U.S. just passed the largest defense bill that it has ever passed. Canada continuously gives money away to large corporations to keep them afloat throughout the course of the pandemic and ensure business continuity. So essentially, like, we've got our governments backstopping industries that have always been able to hoover up money from the federal government. But for the average person, there's nothing. The cupboard is bare. And yet, like, to give a personal anecdote, my sister and her daughter are going to be moving in with us because it is fucking impossible to find a place to live. Why? Because landlords are increasingly skeptical about people's ability to maintain consistent income and are worried about whether their own bills are going to be covered at the end of the month. So rather than simply asking for a pay stub or a letter of employment and some ID, they're asking for bank statements going back as far as 6 months. They're asking for a reference letter from a previous landlord, a reference from a current or past supervisor, a credit check, a criminal background check, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the question is, who under these conditions is the least able to maintain steady employment and to maintain good credit given the situation that we're in? And what is it that our governments are doing to alleviate any of this? And the answer is almost fucking nothing. Student loan repayments are about to begin again, and the company that is going to be collecting student loan payments on behalf of the federal government just lost a major lawsuit where it was accused and was found to have engaged in predatory lending towards that is Navient, right? So the same financial organizations, the same institutions, the same structures are in place now as they were before the pandemic. And we expect that all of this is going to hold together somehow if we just try harder or if we try to define our way out of this crisis. So the problem that I have right now is that it's not just that there's not enough anger going towards our governments for the failures. It's that it seems that they're actively working against our interests at this point. And that's what's frustrating me so much, because I'm like, I can't be the only one that's just like watching everything go to hell around me.
Yeah. And I, you know, I think that there's a clear recognition, a clear awareness on the part of ruling class elites that, as kind of frayed as the social contract was prior to the pandemic, it's become infinitely worse on almost every level, by every metric of mental health, of economic well-being, of consolidation of wealth in the hands of a small group of people at the expense of everybody else, of the ability of people to feel autonomy over their lives, at their anger, at their misdirected rage. It's all being bottled up, and you see evidence of it, and I think there's a genuine fear that instability will result. And I, you know, before I, my life kind of got consumed by the reporting I did in Brazil in 2019 and 2020 with that long investigative series that created a lot of turmoil, I was working on a book that had as its theme the fact that if you drive populations into sufficient levels of deprivation, you basically have two choices. You can either start appeasing their anger or placating it by offering them piecemeal benefits that make their lives just easy enough that you assuage the anger enough so that they don't want to go out onto the street. Or you can decide that you just don't care and that what you're going to do instead is fortify and militarize and just arm yourself against any potential for populist uprising. And I think what you see throughout the West increasingly is the latter choice being made, that there's every Western city is paramilitarizing. We've seen some really disturbing examples, even in Spain, where there was an independence movement that got crushed with an extraordinary amount of police force, unusual for a Western European country. And I think all of these systems being put into place in the name of COVID have kind of been lurking for a while, that are about population control and about managing crises so that really draconian powers are placed on the hands of the state for whenever they need them.
I mean, at this point, I kind of see it as, you know, our governments and our corporations working hand in hand to throw people into the fire as a blood sacrifice to mammon. Let's not even talk about the pivot to the idea that with Omicron being lighter and so much more contagious, you know, we should just accept that we're all going to get it. It's like, but there are people with immune disorders, disabilities, and other comorbidities that place them at much higher risks for death or even further disability. And you just want to ask, like, you want to act like that's, it's just a fact of life. We're going to have to live with that now. You know, welcome to the new normal. That is really fucked up.
It is, but at the same time, it is the case that disruptions to society, forced disruptions to society, extract a major price as well on people's mental health, on people's physical health, on people's ability to survive. And I do think that the longer these shutdowns take place, the more these power centers are being fortified, financial power centers, political power centers. And there is a cost in saying, okay, well, we need to open up and just return to normal and let the Omicron variant do what it's going to do and infect everybody. And at some point, it'll kill off the weakest among us. But there's also a gigantic real human cost to saying, well, we just need to stay locked down indefinitely, keep small businesses closed, continue to let corporate giants enrich themselves, let states continue to consolidate their power, rule by emergency decree. There is a cost on the other side of the ledger, too, that's very substantial.
Well, I'm finding that even, you know, people that consider themselves very progressive are simply like submitting to the idea that increasing what they would call in any other context authoritarianism is fine because we have to deal with an emergency. And the problem is when you give governments this kind of power, they rarely ever reel back on it. Like the Quebec Premier, François Legault, 2 days ago during a press conference, said that what he wants to do is levy a tax on unvaccinated people. That is, when you file your taxes, you may find yourself with a significant penalty based on your health records not indicating that you have gotten the vaccine. And so the amount of people that are otherwise what I thought were sensible commentators who were okay with this idea fucking frightened me. So I was like, so wait a second, you want some tax authority, you want Revenue Canada to be able to access your medical records, determine based on what they find in those records that you should then pay a penalty on, you know, that's entirely based on a medical status, and that he wants the fine to be significant. But you know that any quote-unquote significant fine is always going to affect people without money more so than people with money. So you're going to further immiserate people just to satiate your need for, like, moral superiority because you did what you were supposed to do and get the vaccine. Like, that is actually frightening to me.
Yeah, you know, I had this kind of, I don't want to call it an epiphany because that's too grandiose, but a realization today. I know a few months ago I had kind of put out a call and said, you know, look, there's a lot of criticism all the time aimed at a lot of people on Twitter, and it's very, it's not very conducive to a constructive examination of the validity of that criticism. It's just drive-by attacks. So if you're a critic of mine and you want to actually engage in, like, a more substantive examination of these criticisms you have of my work or of me, you know, I want to invite you to engage in dialogue, like on Rumble, by video, wherever. And several people took me up on it. They emailed me. I did it with one particular person who was the first one to email me. I did about 90 minutes with him. I did about 90 minutes with Jeet here, who has been criticizing me over the course of a year. And there was this one person who kind of popped up early, and he really wanted to do it. And he was like pushing me and pushing me and pushing me. And I was telling him, I think I've already done enough, and I don't really feel like there's a lot of ground left to cover. But he was insistent. He said, you know, you promised me, and he was very persistent. So I finally did it today with him. And he was like this very earnest kid, smart, but young, you know, maybe 23, 24. I think he's at Berkeley. And he was exactly one of those kind of people who identifies as being on the left, but has no historical sense of historical events prior to Trump. Like, his kind of political sensibility begins and ends with the emergence of Trump on the scene. And he was offended, for example, by the idea that the FBI might be engaged in you know, treachery or shenanigans with regards to January 6th, or placing informants and inciting people into attacks the way they did throughout the first war on terror. And so for me, for so long, when I was watching stuff with COVID or even this, like, attempt to put the war on terror onto domestic soil in the name of January 6th, I couldn't understand why people hadn't learned their lesson, because having lived through 9/11, where the same thing happened, where all these powers that were claimed were necessary just for the emergency and the crisis of the terrorist attack, 20 years later are still in place. Almost none of them has been rescinded. Many of them have expanded wildly beyond their control, their original intent, even though there was no more mass casualty attack on the scale of 9/11 after 9/11, 20 years later. And I realize it's because each generation kind of produces people with historical amnesia. So they're kind of immersed in the propaganda about the benevolence of the security state, about the trustworthiness of our institutions. And they believe, when they're told that these powers are being claimed in the name of an emergency, that they really are being done for the public good, because they have no historic reference.
I remember back when you didn't even go through metal detectors to get on an airplane.
Right. Yeah, in our lifetime.
We were in some wild times way back in the 80s. You simply, like, you went to the airport, you went to your gate, you got on a plane. That was that. Right? So this whole, like the security theater that we go through, which none of it has actually been, like, shown to have saved lives or deter terrorist attacks or anything of the sort. Like, it's almost like every year they find some way to further degrade and dehumanize people at the airport. I mean, I know people that have had, for example, body modifications that showed up on the backscatter and have, like, ended up getting more or less groped by airport security. I know people that have had to, like, come out and disclose their assigned gender at birth due to this security theater. Like, nobody enjoys it, but there doesn't seem to be any way around the increasing, like, intrusion, not just on our privacy, but in, like, on our bodies, in order to go from place to place. And this, to me, kind of represents the final frontier on that, the idea that a federal or government agency can cross-reference your health records and then decide, based on what they find in your health records, whether to further tax you. Like, that's like, I'm almost at the point. I have friends. Well, actually, my childhood best friend, this past year in November, moved out of Canada with his family. They now live in Ghana, and he said, like, I'm done. That's it. I can't do this anymore. This is too fucking stressful. I've wanted to go for a long time. Maybe this is a sign. Yeah. So him and his whole family are gone, and I have other friends and family members that have gone back to the Caribbean, that have moved back to Latin America, have moved to China. And I'm almost saying to myself, is there something that they know that I don't? Or is there a bit of wisdom that they have that I'm lacking? Because I know that it cannot be like this all over the world, where people are sitting there driving themselves crazy thinking about these things.
Yeah. You know, I think that's how it works, is at, you know, there's a little bit of an incursion, people object for a while, and then it kind of settles down and people accept it. And then there's another incursion and the same thing happens. I remember, you probably remember really well, when the TSA instituted its more invasive procedures, there was a huge outcry for weeks about the idea that it's, you know, that federal agents were going to actually be able to grope us in our groin area, in our, if you know, in these new machines anything was detected. It was inconceivable that it would happen. And maybe there was a few weeks or a month or so of anger, and the TSA defended it and waited for that anger to die down, and now everybody knows those procedures and never thinks twice about the fact that that's what they're like. There was this really interesting psychological study I read where, in I think it was 1976, New York City under then Mayor Ed Koch announced for the first time that it was going to be a law that people were required to pick up the poop that their dog leaves on the street when they're walking their dog. And when this idea was introduced, everybody thought it was insane. I mean, people were like, are you fucking crazy? I'm not going to pick up my dog shit. That, I mean, is the government, have they completely lost their mind? It was regarded as something so radical.
It was a wild time back in the 80s, because you couldn't go to a children's playground without having to, like, you had to know the lay of the land before you played a game of tag. So in some respects, like, you know, maybe some of what is seen as overreach is now, I think, closer to common sense. Like, you should, as a dog owner, be picking up after your dog. You should be putting
definitely
on yourself and your children. Like, I can get that. But I think where it comes to it as a matter of keeping us safe, and there's just no evidence as to what degree of safety we have now that we didn't have previously, that we have to, you know, allow these intrusions or even encourage them. That part is what is keeping me up at night.
Right. All I'm saying with that dog poop example, and of course, I mean, you know, as a dog owner, I walk on the street, I have bags, I don't think twice about it. I lived in New York for years with dogs, and, you know, I looked askance at people who didn't do it. All I'm saying is that because of how we are social and political animals, and we're so connected to a kind of group identity, even though we like to think of ourselves as these rugged individuals who make up our own minds about everything independent of external pressure, the ability of this kind of collective to change attitudes very quickly and very radically is extremely powerful. And you can get entire societies to go almost overnight, you know, figuratively speaking, from being repulsed at an idea to being fanatically supportive of it. And that, you know, you can use it for good. Sometimes you can change mores to make people behave in a way that is better for society, like the dog scooping rule, the poop scooping rule. But it also, you can see the gigantic potential for mischief. And I do think we're seeing that with COVID, where 2 years into the pandemic, the acceptance of extreme levels of control over what we do and how we do it, and the undemocratic means with which it's decided, these mayors are still ruling by emergency decree enacted in March of 2020, with very little protest. There's more in Western Europe than there is in North America.
Yeah.
But, yeah. You know, that's what I find disturbing is there's very little protest to much of this at all.
Well, I mean, the protests that do exist are, you know, you've got a softer view of them than I do. But, you know, the protests that are popping up here are led by fucking crazy people and fascists. But that's a whole other kettle of fish. Oh, by the way, speaking of protests, wow, it took us a little while to find ourselves on our actual, like, dedicated agenda here.
Yeah.
But how did you enjoy the show last week? How were you finding the pageantry, the one sec- I thought it was excellent. I enjoyed the dresses. I enjoyed the gowns. I thought some people came up with some interesting fashion choices.
I feel like the reason I enjoyed it is because I feel like if they're gonna do it, if they're really gonna go just like full cringe, then the worse it becomes, the more enjoyable it was. So obviously the highlight, I think for everybody, it was when Nancy Pelosi very earnestly introduced Lin-Manuel Miranda and the cast of Hamilton to sermonize on and then sing about the importance of democracy.
It was everything I could have ever dreamed of. I was coming up with like ideas for how bad it could get. Like I thought that they were going to have somebody like spontaneously break out into song on the congressional floor. This is what I actually thought was going to happen. And then they won up to me by inviting Lin-Manuel fucking Miranda to serenade them. That was just, mwah. It was fantastic.
Yeah, and had it not been for COVID, they wouldn't have appeared by Zoom. They would have actually been doing a number on the House floor.
Costume and everything, yeah.
Exactly. So they really outdid themselves. And, you know, I mean, obviously, this pageantry, you know, has a purpose. And it's not just a political purpose. I don't really think Democrats believe that it's a winning political issue for them to paint Republicans as this existential threat to democracy. Polls show it's not really working any better than Russiagate worked. I think it's a much more sinister purpose. I don't think it's just like a partisan advantage purpose. There's a little bit of that. I think it's really much more about ensuring that there's always a perception of a existential threat that can justify the kinds of powers we've been discussing. Just today, there were the first indictments in 20 or in 11 years where Americans were charged with sedition. The last time Americans were charged with sedition was this kind of fringe militia that the Obama Justice Department got convinced was devoted to overthrowing the government, and the court threw out all of the charges based on the view that they were just engaged in protected speech against the government. I can't imagine these sedition prosecutions are going to succeed here. They clearly were brought not because the Justice Department thinks they're going to succeed, but because there was enormous political pressure by Democrats to charge sedition. But this whole climate, when you start having sedition charges thrown around, our talk of insurrection and coup, the idea that the greatest national security threat comes from domestic soil and not from foreign threats, obviously creates a climate where the security state services are going to be awash in money and in surveillance authority and in all kinds of powers. And that is very much what this is all about.
Right. One thing that I have been rather disturbed by, like, I'm not sure if you, there are some Twitter accounts that I follow that are absolutely fucking cursed, and I can't, they're too compelling to not follow them, because it's like, as I'm tracking the gradual like mental breakdown of the people behind these accounts, I feel like they're almost like a microcosm or like a bellwether for what's happening with people that are like political fellow travelers. So the Occupy Democrats account has gone so far as to, like, I don't want to say celebrate, but was very very eager to talk about the heroicness of the Capitol police officer that shot and killed Ashley Babbitt. And I'm like, okay, so, you know, putting all the jokes aside for a second, right? Because to me, that was the funniest day in American history. 1-6-2021, we will never have another day like it. But the fact that this account was, like, bleating praise towards officers that kept Congress and democracy safe, and killed an insurrectionist or a traitor or however it was that they described them. I'm like, so you've actually, like, you've just full on embraced the fascism. This shop-worn phrase, you know, scratch a liberal and a fascist bleeds. I'm like, you're actually doing it in real time. And I've seen so many people that the previous year were, I don't even know if I would say that they were talking about abolish the police. People were always hedging their bets with defund the police. But I did see a lot of defund the police types just pivot so effortlessly to thanking the Capitol police officers who defended American democracy and even talking about affording more resources to the police to keep the rest of us safe. This the very same people. I wish I had actually like kept a tally because I never expected it to happen that quickly. So yeah, that like one of the worst signifiers of that event was just how many people have no political principles whatsoever. It's just a matter of wherever the popular discourse is going, they're there with it. They're willing to write think pieces and appear on panel discussions, etc. But when it comes to standing on their square, and like I'll give an example of this. A lot of people who have argued against solitary confinement, people who have argued against cruel and unusual punishment in prison, have argued against the carceral state, against the inequality of the justice system, yada, 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 have said, not only said nothing about, but in many cases are gloating at the fact that Jake Angeli, the QAnon Viking or the QAnon shaman or whatever people call him, is getting inordinate amounts of solitary confinement. And
years of prison time, years of prison time, despite no violent assault, no violent charge, no charges of violence of any kind.
He got almost 4 years, didn't he?
Yeah, he got on top of the year he's already spent in solitary.
Right. So it's like, okay, so I get that you want to make an example of people when they embarrass you in your own workplace. I completely get that lawmakers are putting a lot of pressure on prosecutors to make an example of these people. But almost 4 years and serving that much time. Nobody should be serving solitary confinement. Nobody. Solitary confinement should not be a thing that happens in prisons, period. And people seem to be happy about this, that like, well, he's, you know, shoe doesn't feel so good on the other foot, does it? And it's like, yeah, he might be wearing it for a little while, but the vast majority, like what you've done is normalize this kind of treatment of prisoners. So there's going to be a hell of a lot of people whose names you're never going to know that are not going to make the news, that are going to get the exact same kinds of treatment. It's almost like that drill tweet, you know, looking back at the audience as I turn up the racism meter. And it's like your government is looking at you and what you say and how you think and the kinds of opinions you express to determine how far they can take these punishments with people that you don't care about. And that's what bothers me about this, is that people simply cannot stand on their square and don't understand how much it encourages further wanton cruelty from the justice system when they cheer this kind of shit.
You know, I mean, it was so frustrating. There were so many frustrating parts about Russiagate for me, but one of them was the complete relinquishment on the part of certainly the liberals, but they were never big criminal justice reform advocates to begin with, but even parts of the left, where so many of the prosecutions against these like admittedly scummy people like Michael Flynn relied on theories of criminality that had been at the heart of the criminal justice reform movement forever. The main one of which was that Michael Flynn, when he was charged by Robert Mueller and led to plead guilty, using all the standard tactics that prosecutors use to induce guilty pleas, even when people aren't guilty, they threaten to bring charges against his son. That's a very common prosecutorial tactic to threaten family members. They warned him that if he didn't plead guilty, he would face 10 years in prison instead of getting probation as a recommendation if he cooperated, all the typical tools that they use. But the criminal offense that he pled guilty to was that he lied to the FBI, that when the FBI came to interview him or asked him to come and be interviewed about his conversations with Ambassador Kislyak in the transition, he falsely denied having spoken about the lifting of sanctions. And this idea that the FBI can turn you into a criminal by coming and interviewing you and luring you to falsely deny things that you've done that you know the FBI would look askance at,
right,
has been like a major, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the seminal opinion arguing that that should not be a crime, that the FBI should not be able to turn you into a criminal by getting you to lie to them without them proving that there was an underlying crime. So, but it was impossible to get people to get past their hatred for Michael Flynn or the Trump administration and to realize the principles at stake. And that is so often the tactic that ruling class elites use, is they purposely pick people in the first. It's what they're doing with Julian Assange, you know, one of the most hated people for a long time on the right and now on the left because of what he did in 2016, to institute a precedent that it would be extremely dangerous to the practice of journalism, knowing that there are enough people who hate him that they're willing to overlook the consequences of it. And by the time they're done, it's going to be too late. That will be a principle that you can no longer challenge when it's used against people that you feel better about. That's always the tactic.
Right. And as you know, we brought up with Kyle Rittenhouse a while back, is that you know, many people who called the trial itself a validation of white supremacy didn't even stop to think, like, just didn't even blink about the fact that they knew like Kyle Rittenhouse's name and the fact that he was charged as an adult. Well, why was this procedure in which he was charged as an adult almost like summary in the state of Wisconsin? Well, for the very same reason that a lot of young black people in a state that has the highest percentage of incarcerated black youth in the entire union, the very same legal method through which Kyle Rittenhouse was summarily charged as an adult happens to thousands upon thousands of black youth in the state of Wisconsin every fucking year. They don't care about that, but they want to talk about the fact that Rittenhouse was acquitted, that is an act of white supremacy. Like, talk about missing the forest for the trees. The problem is the actual system that brings a Kyle Rittenhouse into the public eye and becoming national news, because as a juvenile, you shouldn't even know his name. But, I mean, you know, when I talk about this stuff with normies, I sound like a crazy person. But this is the stuff that, again, keeps me up at night.
Yeah. So why don't we've kind of been very organic about the issues we covered.
I got one more thing.
I was going to suggest that before we get to the queue, we should talk about that Nation article on China that you had wanted to talk about, unless you'd rather replace that with something else.
Let's table it for next week, because I think it is going to require a bit of time and going through to unpack some of the stuff that David Kleon did. Including like just flat out smearing Vijay Prashad. Which, I don't know, man.
You're going to lure me into this if you start it.
Okay, no, I'm just going to say, like, I've been back and forth on my opinion of David Kleon's writing, but that piece in The Nation that he wrote was fucking abysmal. And the fact that he would take not only, like, an Indian academic, but an Indian academic who has fought tirelessly against the caste, like, he's fought against casteism and has been one of the people that's instrumental in breaking down some of those social barriers. And you introduce them to American audiences as somebody who denies such a thing as cultural genocide exists. Like, fuck you, buddy.
So anyway, for people who don't know, the article that Q is just referencing that we'll talk about next week, because I do think it does, as horrible as he and it are, present some interesting questions about the China debate. But it's an article in The Nation published this week, headlined, "What Should the Left Do About China?" So if you want to check that out, hate read it, and we'll definitely have a lot to say about it next week. Did you have an additional topic you wanted to cover before we go to the queue?
Yeah, the hack to Substack pipeline.
All right, go ahead.
Glenn.
Set the stage for this so people know what we're talking about.
Yeah. Okay, so there is a journalist that worked previously with CBC, and that is the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And so CBC has, at various points in my lifetime, at the very least, been celebrated as, you know, the triumph of what is possible when a crown corporation lends itself to informing the public, and also been vilified as liberal propaganda that is there to demonize conservative values, that is basically like one of the harbingers of white genocide, is how extreme I've heard it put.
It's similar to like the NPR, the debate in the U.S. about NPR. I wouldn't say it's identical, but it's similar.
Right. Well, the CBC is like, it's our national news broadcaster. So it's not just radio, but it's also television. Like,
right.
It's an institution in Canada. Some of like our most, you know, memorable television moments, some of our most memorable sports moments came out of CBC broadcasting. But that all being said, there was a former writer slash producer by the name of Tara Henley that worked with CBC and resigned recently and launched a Substack. And she did in her Substack what I find that a lot of journalists have been doing, which is working with a legacy institution for a number of years and then launching the next phase of their career by trashing that publication that previously let them, like, as far as I understand, didn't stop them from writing about or speaking about what they want to write or speak about. And like use the whipping up of the mob frenzy towards not only CBC, but quote unquote woke publications in their entirety, that mainstream news is there to engage in a mass affirmative action project to make minorities feel good, but not there to deliver actual news or report on the material circumstances of people. And it really bothered me because she opened her Substack letter saying that people want to know why, for example, non-binary Filipinos concerned about a lack of LGBT terms in Tagalog is an editorial priority for the CBC. Tagalog is like the ethnic language of Filipino people. Is an editorial policy or priority for the CBC when local issues of broad concern go unreported. So it's like, okay, so you're doing the whole, okay, so, you know, who's going to play the next Superman? Is it going to be a blind, wheelchair-using, trans Turkish woman? And it's like, the reason that they go as far as this hyperbole is to make people believe that while matters that are important to minority communities get covered, the larger and more concerning issues are going unreported or that these journalists are being muzzled somehow. So she got widespread acclamation for the substance of the Substack letter, which basically said the CBC is, I'm paraphrasing here, but the CBC is more concerned about engaging in woke politics than actually covering the news that matters to people. And the National Post reprinted the Substack. Fox News picked it up. She was on various TV programs. She went on Canada Land, a media criticism program run by Jesse Brown in Canada, of which I used to host a podcast. And she was also on your show. You interviewed her.
I did.
First of all, I'm like, why the constant psychodrama in journal? Like, I feel like this is stuff that only other fucking journalists care about. I don't care why you left your publication. I really couldn't give a shit. But if you are going to trash your former publication, you're going to use if you're going to burn career bridges to fuel your next venture, they have to at least make sense. Tara Henley writing intrepid journalism or daring articles that challenged the status quo and was muzzled by the CBC. She was writing articles like 5 underrated tourist spots in Vancouver or how I got myself out of $60,000 in graduate student debt. Or here are the 5, hidden eateries that tourists should visit in Vancouver. And it's like, so you're basically doing travel, tourism, and lifestyle writing. What was so pressing and so urgent that you felt needed to be reported on that wasn't getting reported on? And what matters of import to the Canadian public was the CBC deprioritizing in order to, I mean, I find it rather interesting that Tagalog speakers in Canada have noticed that language regarding LGBT concerns are not making direct translations. Like there's no words for them. I think that, I mean, as somebody who studies history, part of which like linguistics comes under my purview, like I find that interesting, but I'm wondering like, okay, so what story did it knock off of the priority list in order to get there? And the answer is, and I didn't hear anybody except for Jesse Brown ask her this question. Okay, so what was missing? Like, what was it that was so important to be reported that wasn't getting reported, or that you wanted to say that you couldn't say? You couldn't fucking answer the question.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, obviously I have a little bit of a personal stake in these kind of stories because I actually cycled through my own resignation that was not necessarily identical to hers, but had some similarities thematically. And certainly in my case, what prompted my leaving was
something that you wanted to write about.
No, that was exactly what I was about to say, was that in my case, but not only in my case, I was actually barred from saying what I wanted to say. So there are instances where people are being told that they can't say what they want to say. I can't tell you how many times during the Russiagate four-year saga I was contacted by young journalists, even mid-level journalists, inside major media outlets to say privately to me, I'm really grateful for the skepticism you're expressing on these stories. I wish I could do it, but I know that in the context of my media outlet, I would never be able to get away with it. I would end up laid off. I would end up fired. So for me, look, I didn't know Tara Henley before this happened. I don't have an opinion about her work or the validity of her particular grievances. But what I do think is that the reason why I see this as more than psychodrama is for two reasons. One is media outlets are extremely influential in our society. They're a major part of how ruling class elites disseminate propaganda. They are a big factor in determining what people think about, what they don't think about, how they talk about things, how they don't talk about those things. And so debates about what's taking place inside of them, to me, is not industry gossip. It's the same as any other influential institutional actor where we should want to know what kind of changes are taking place in terms of how they're conducting themselves. And I think, you know, the reason why it resonated what she said, even if you're right that she was not a particularly good vessel for it, is because it is undeniably true, whether it's good or bad, and I think there are elements of both, that the protest movements of 2020, by design, changed how people think in a lot of elite institutions and how they speak about a lot of different issues. And so, of course, that's going to provoke a lot of debate inside these institutions about whether those changes are good or bad. Some people are going to see them as good. Some people are going to see them as bad.
What changes are you talking about?
Well, clearly there was a elevation of the need to be what some liberals would call racially sensitive, what some people would call kind of woke ideology, this sort of like liberal facade.
Who is engaging in woke ideology in news institutions? Who? I would like to know this.
Go listen to NPR and all you will hear.
I listen to NPR.
You don't
watch CBC. I listen to CBC radio.
I'm just telling you, we're never going to get it resolved because ultimately it's a subjective perception whether you think that the output is all I'm telling you is that people's experiences, this is why I think she was worthy of being heard, because when so many people are having the same experience that she's having, I think that...
What experience are you talking about? What experience did she have?
She described what the changes were in this newsroom where all kinds of reporting ended up being colored and shaped by this new ethos.
She didn't cleanse.
I mean, let me just ask you. Do you deny... Yeah. There was a financial figure I saw, money is often a good indicator, that from 2011 until 2019, $3.5 billion of oligarchical wealth went into racial equity and racial equality activist organizations. From 2019 until 2020, that number quadrupled.
Pledged. Did they actually pay the money out? No, in many instances they didn't. That's what they pledged.
Well, there's a huge amount more money going into these groups than there was before. There's no denying that. I mean, just like Jeff Bezos' wife on her own has handed out enormous sums of money to groups like this. So has Soros. So has a lot of these NGOs, the Ford Foundation.
They don't give money to – they don't just like pick a charity and give money. They essentially start an organization and give money to their own organization and then claim it as a charitable donation.
They also donate money. Do you deny that like there has been a change in the discourse after the 2020 protest?
I'm going to put this. There's been a change in the discourse. What's happened is that people have been able to adopt enlightened sounding language while engaging in the exact same structural workplace and economic practices, the same policing practices that they were previously. I think a lot of people have this idea that there has been some major institutional shift that's taken place. And it's like, no, all they learned to do is speak a different language. We're basically relitigating the political correctness debates of the mid to late 1990s.
Yeah, but imposing different language requirements on people is something that people are going to experience as censorship, or at least this control, like the being told that you can't express yourself or can't express yourself.
People were upset that they couldn't call gay people homosexuals on the news in the 90s. And they called that local correctness run amok.
Obviously, like I said before, there are good and bad elements to all changes. So if you were talking about the change being that there is greater attention to the pathology of police brutality and the lack of accountability when police officers engage in unjustified violence.
Police have gotten more money now. They are richer. They have gotten larger budgets this
year than they did
the previous year. After everybody complained that, after every pundit and every columnist, every pro police,
why is that? Why did that happen?
Why in liberal cities defunding the police is leading to a
why did that happen? Why in liberal cities did funding for the police increase?
Because that's what happens every year. They asked for it.
Well, there was like a referendum in Minneapolis about whether
the referendum failed.
They asked the voters of the city.
Do you want to
basically dismantle the police as it exists and create a different way of doing policing? And it failed, and it failed in particular in predominantly minority neighborhoods. Okay. So, you know, I think that a lot of these changes have happened on a superficial level in elite institutions,
you're still talking about, like, so the changes that you're talking about are aesthetic and linguistic, but what actual structural changes have happened?
Well, I think that journalists inside organizations are more restricted in the kind of reporting that they can do because there's a much lighter hair trigger. I'll give you an example that I think that I always find like illustrative. So after the protest movement, you know, obviously a lot of the protest movements were peaceful. A lot of them involved property damage. Going and asking how many people, how many small businesses lost their businesses as a result of arson or other property destruction, how many of these people who were told or who people said, oh, don't worry, they have insurance, actually got fully reimbursed, how many of them ended up having to close permanently. It's the sort of thing you would want to know, that's the kind of thing you would want to report on. You would want to report on attitudes in minority communities where a lot of these protests take place about whether these activists were actually speaking on their behalf or whether they felt the protests were negative for their community.
I'm glad you brought that up. You know why I'm glad you brought it up, Glenn? I knew you were going to. There was a New York Times article last year in November that talked about the long-term damage.
Exactly. Five months after, that was by Barry Weiss's girlfriend, Nellie Bowers.
Okay. All right.
She wasn't even supposed to be the reporter. She's a tech reporter. She kind of had to smuggle that in. Michael Tracy spent that summer with his little shitty car and his little shitty cell phone going around and interviewing small business owners who lost their businesses. And that was like the full extent of the coverage because newsrooms were afraid of being perceived as being in any way against these protests, which is why they were afraid to report on the damage that was done to these communities.
Who are the journalists that were trying to file these stories and weren't able to?
I mean, I'm just telling you, like, even at The Intercept, there was absolutely like a freeze on the ability to go and report on that ledger, that side of the ledger. It wasn't reporting, it became activism. And let me just make one last point about this, like, kind of, you know, I forget how you phrased it, but like grifter or Substack pipeline or whatever. There's a perception.
Substack pipeline. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a perception that I hear all the time that the way that there's a financial motive to voice these grievances because it's like the path to riches or whatever. If you go and look at,
I don't think it's the path to riches.
Okay. But I'm just since a lot of people do, let me just make this point. If you go and look at who the highest earners are in Substack, what you'll find is that they're essentially the same people who have sold the most books over the last 5 years. They're the people who have gotten the most promotions. They're basically just like anti-Trump resistance pablum disseminators. That's who makes the most money in media. The way to make the most money in the media is not by being anti-woke. It's by being an alarmist about the Trump movement, about Donald Trump's movement, about the insurrection of January 6th, about Russiagate. Though that's where the financial incentives lie. And so I'm not saying you have to necessarily believe that Tara Henley's grievances are all valid, but the idea that she has some kind of sinister motive in order to fabricate them for financial gain. Like, I doubt she's going to make. I'm not saying you did, but I'm not saying you did, but a lot of people did. I bet she makes very little money on Substack.
I mean, probably. But that's because she has to have something that's worth saying or hearing that is not available in other mainstream publications. And what I'm saying to you is, out of what she's written so far, there's nothing that she's said that I wouldn't be able to find in, like, the National Post, or that I wouldn't be able to find in the Washington Post, or pretty much anywhere else. I've seen articles like what she's written for her Substack published in The Guardian. So I'm not really clear where she's being muzzled. And then the second thing is, I don't believe that she had any sort of sinister intent. What I do believe, though, is that a lot of people, especially who are working in journalism, who are not talented enough to write the kinds of stories that they feel need to be written, whether it's out of, like, professional fear that they're going to be sticking their necks out by writing it, or they simply lack the talent to do so, sit around and fucking complain about all of the stuff that's going uncovered, all of these matters of public import that are going by the wayside because of quote-unquote woke politics. And I am telling you, as somebody who watches CBC on a regular basis and somebody who has been trying to recover from the brain poisoning that was inflicted on me by a steady diet of MSNBC and CNN, all of the stuff that is broadcast on those networks are reinforcing status quo narratives with polite language. The people that actually have the most difficult time getting stories published at these legacy institutions are, for the most part, people of minority backgrounds, whether it's a gender minority, whether it's an ethnic minority. But when they try to publish stories that concern either their communities or communities like theirs, especially in comparison to what a larger point of view might be about those communities or how they butt up against institutions, for example, trying to talk about, say, migrant laborers in Canada, talking about immigration detention, trying to have conversations in the United States about Indigenous people, about First Nations people, about Native people, almost fucking impossible. Those are the people that have a hard time getting their stories published. People like Tara Henley can fart out 3 articles on, like, hotspots in Vancouver before the afternoon is out and suffer no negative consequences to their career whatsoever because this stuff never interested them in the first place. So it's always, I feel like somebody should be talking about this, but it's never them until they want to launch their career by blowing up a mine underneath themselves to take out their former institutions and make it seem as if everybody that's still working there is working under a muzzle, or basically, like, have, like, I don't know, like prison guards walking up and down the cubicles, eyeing over the dividers to make sure that whatever is being bashed out on their typewriters or on their keyboards conforms to a woke standard. And I'm telling you, that's absolute bullshit.
Yeah, all right. I mean, I feel like her critique of the CBC was more nuanced than that. When I interviewed her, she actually repudiated that kind of maximalist narrative that it was like some kind of regime of censorship that had been harshly imposed and that no one can do good journalism at the CBC. She was a lot more nuanced about it than that. I don't know.
I'm not even a fan of the CBC myself. I think the CBC is a terrible institution. Yeah.
I think people, you know, if you want, my interview with her is on Rumble. You can hear her there. Like Q said, she's been interviewed by several other people as well. She kind of made the media rounds for a week or so. So feel free to check out her. I was interested in kicking the tires on what she had to say precisely because I wasn't familiar with her work and I wanted to see exactly what her grievance was. So anyway, why don't we go ahead and that's a lot of, we covered a lot of ground.
I just want to say one last thing on this matter, which is that there are substantive and principled critiques to be made of news media, especially as they ape and parrot the aesthetics of enlightened liberal points of view. I think there are very substantive critiques to be made of them. But the people who tend to make them do it in such a ham-fisted manner that it's hard to even, it's hard to even take the side that these institutions need to be torn down, because the people who are the most vocal about it also have the worst fucking arguments as to how to do that.
I think also that your politics come into play there, given that you do, by your own, you know, description, reside on the far left spectrum of the political process. And so I don't think it's surprising that
the benefit is of coming from the quote unquote far left or coming from the commie side It's a little adage that came from Chairman Mao, and it goes a little something like this: no investigation, no right to speak. So until you know about what it is that you're talking about and have something to back you up, then you should probably stay quiet until you get that information, and then you talk about it. And what I find is that everybody has an opinion, and hardly anybody understands how the sausage is made inside of newsrooms. And even the people who do know about it are willing to feed into those popular misconceptions to make it seem as if there's like mass affirmative action happening, that newsrooms exist to enforce affirmative action journalism, and that has never been the case.
All right. Obviously, there are a lot of people who work in those newsrooms who see that differently, but
they can all kiss my ass because they're lying to themselves. But anyway, all right. Take some calls.
All right. Do you want me to play Master of Ceremonies and do the work the queue, or do you want to take that on your own?
Because you tapped into the room before I did. You're now the host, and I'm just
exactly whoever gets here first has the honor. So first up is Sam. Go ahead and unmute yourself, and we should be able to hear you.
Hi there. I hope you guys are doing well. I appreciate you guys coming on here and expressing your points of view. And Glenn, I really appreciate your work with Snowden and Manning.
Thank you.
Really changed my life and my perspective. And Anthony, I feel like our deals really align. I'm following you now, and I can't wait to hear more from you. And I'll be looking you up in your work. I wanted to begin by talking about the ethical quandary of accelerationism versus the inevitable corporate takeover of our institutions, or inept institutions. But rather, after hearing you, I decided that maybe it's better to talk about wokeness and the shaming of online entities. And I know that you talked about the wordplay of he, she, and you know all of the current wokeness that's obvious and superficial, but rather there's a shaming that's going on that's causing an extreme amount of censorship and self-censorship, both externally and internally within Facebook, Twitter, Jack Dorsey stepping down, the dislike button being removed from YouTube. And I'm concerned about the current trend. I'm wondering what your perspective is on where this is going, and is there any way that you see us moving away from censorship? I feel like it's a systemic force due to I personally think it's due to the overall debt in the economy, and these forces are going to continue trending forward. But do you see any resolution towards this, or what do you see coming from this?
Well, I mean, I guess I'll go first, since it's an issue on which I focus a great deal. Obviously, I do regard a free internet as something that was one of the most important potential innovations to empower individuals against centralized power. And I kind of regard it as a lost cause, given how centralized that power has now become and how aggressively speech and the dissemination of information are being policed and controlled and monitored by almost an infinite number of power centers for their own ends. But what I do see is the emergence of new ecosystems on the internet. And obviously that's part of what I think we're doing here. It's part of why I'm on Rumble. It's part of why I'm on Substack. I personally try hard to fortify those venues that are designed to emancipate people from the centralized control that are devoted to protecting the full range of debate without deplatforming people or policing them or punishing them for wandering off outside of the boundaries of ideological conformity set by institutions. And then I wouldn't say enthusiastic, but definitely curious about the next iteration of the internet, which a lot of people think will be based on blockchain technology or Bitcoin or crypto. I'm not interested in that as a currency. Not completely uninterested, but I'm much more interested in the ability of that technology to do what encryption was supposed to do, but has more or less failed, which is shield the internet from the ability of power centers to control it. But if you look at who's thriving and who's succeeding, I do think it's kind of encouraging in that there is a public craving for a discourse that is more independent. It's almost like the more corporate backing you have, the more identity you have that depends upon large corporations, the less credibility you have with large numbers of people. And I find that trend encouraging.
Oh, well,
sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry. Can you?
I believe that there is some degree of self-censorship happening, but I don't think that it's happening in a way that a lot of people think it is. I think that what a lot of people describe as the process of self-censorship is what happens. Like, these are just the normal vicissitudes of encountering groups of people that you at one point didn't necessarily have to have a lot of respect for, and now it is socially accepted, if not socially encouraged, that you should be polite to people. I think of, for example, like discourse around trans people. Like, in my lifetime, I've seen a complete 180, but things are much different now than when I was younger. I had a very close relative that worked in group homes for runaway teens. And I grew up around a lot of street kids, many of whom were trans youth that had to escape their homes due to sexual abuse, physical abuse, or simply not being accepted. And the way that they were spoken about by the general public, as compared to like my own experience growing up around like teenage trans people, night and day. And it's always affected me to hear the way that they're spoken about. But now I think that there is a lot more humanity afforded to trans people. I mean, they're obviously not there yet, but there's a lot more humanity afforded to trans people than when I was growing up. And I think some people have taken the necessity of, addressing people by their proper pronouns, not even as like an enforcement, but a simple like, hey, this is the polite thing to do, to address trans women and trans men by the names that they've taken and not by their birth names, not to dead name them. Simple polite things to do that are new to our society, I think people are taking that as almost like a personal attack. So I think when we get into the area of self-censorship, I think a lot of what we describe as self-censorship is like, well, just don't be a fucking asshole. On the other hand, where it comes to talking about some of the larger and broader issues, talking about how, as Glenn and I were talking about earlier in this episode, the encroachment of the surveillance state and the police state onto our daily lives, talking about why we can't have conversations regarding pharmaceutical companies essentially paying to overcome barriers to getting these vaccines out to market, why they haven't released their patent restrictions, what they're doing to countries in the global south, some of the onerous and inhumane terms that they've imposed on countries to simply have access to them. Like, having conversations about that stuff turns you into an anti-vaxxer. Having conversations about whether vaccine mandates are not only like a legal or an ethical, but a simple moral thing to do, people will say that you sound like an anti-vaxxer. And talking about foreign policy, saying that the United States doesn't have a right to simply intervene in any country that it wants, or that the state of Israel should cease conducting its campaign of genocide against Palestinians. That's the kind of stuff that will actually get you vilified in the mainstream. And the reason that I know that's true is look up Valentina Azarova, a professor who was supposed to go and work at the University of Toronto and found herself out of a job because she's written articles that were critical of the state of Israel. That's your cancel culture. Your cancel culture is not somebody said something incredibly hurtful and disparaging, people let them know how they feel about it, and now they're upset, but yet making more money and getting more attention than they were in the first place.
Let me just add a point on that. I mean, I agree with a lot of that, and then parts of that I don't. So, you know, I've written for years that the greatest amount of censorship institutionally in the West is aimed at defenders of Palestinian rights or critics of Israel, which is absolutely true. And so many people on the right either ignore that when waving the free speech or cancel culture banner or whatever, or actively support it. And that critique is very valid. We even have laws in 28 states, primarily sponsored by Republican governors, though not only, that essentially require people to pledge a loyalty oath to Israel, that they're never going to boycott Israel as a condition for getting state contracts. An incredibly unconstitutional law, that has been declared such by the four federal courts that have evaluated it. But the fact that they're even passed in states shows that by far and away, the easiest way to censor or cancel or whatever you want to call it is still when it comes to critics of Israel, which I know a lot of people on the right don't like to accept, but it's nonetheless true. That said, I also do think that the self-censorship is a little bit more serious than what Q had just suggested. It is true that sometimes we're talking, the complaints, the grievances are aimed at actual progress. I do think it's a good thing that people who identify as trans or non-binary or whatever feel more comfortable being able to self-identify because there's a greater taboo on mocking or attacking or stigmatizing them. I'm always in favor of a climate or culture that fosters greater amounts of self-actualization. But I'll just share this one anecdote because I've talked about this before. I went to dinner a couple of years ago with two very, very well-established, successful, secure journalists, secure in their career journalists, both of whom have teenage children, who are dating trans kids. And we're talking about how common it is in their high school for these kids, so many of them, more than ever before, to seek out hormonal treatment or even once they hit 16 and 17 to have surgeries, to have permanent surgeries, mastectomies and the like. And they were questioning whether kids at that age, 15, 16, 17, are emotionally equipped to make decisions of that kind. They weren't arguing one way or the other. They were saying, this is a really new thing, and I haven't really figured out yet what my view on this is. Like, what types of age cutoff should we have for various kinds of decisions that can be irreversible of this kind? And we had a really interesting conversation about it. We explored it. We looked at both sides of it the way you would when you're having dinner with friends. And afterwards, I realized there was zero chance, zero, that either of them would ever go and express those questions or concerns on their journalistic platform because they're primarily associated with the left, and to do that would be far too risky. And again, there was no malice to what they were saying. There was nothing at all anti-trans about it. But obviously, if you go and start asking those questions or the question about fairness in sports or anything else like that, you do pay a big price for it. And I think what Q said earlier, which is like a lot of time these grievances are just about people who are cowards, who aren't willing to, in journalism, to stand up and, you know, take some heat or take some criticism. I think that's completely true. But I'm just saying, I do also think there is a lot of self-censorship. I talked earlier about the people contacting me during Russiagate saying, I wish I could express this skepticism, but I know I can't. It'll hurt my career too much. I do think that's a very real thing. And maybe, you know, Q is right that these journalists just need to suck it up. But it's also asking a lot for people to risk their careers, risk their jobs, risk their reputation, withstand those kinds of attacks when they're not as secure in their career as these two people that I was referencing are. So I
have
think
a reputation among my peers as a genocide denier because I asked simple questions and questioned dubious studies and dubiously sourced information. If I can take that kind of heat, then whatever it is that they feel that they aren't able to say, they can do the same thing. I'm a freelancer. These are staff people.
I get it. Yeah. I think you're right. I think you're right. I think you're right about that. All right. Why don't we, Sam, thank you very much for that question. Let's try and take a couple more with the time that we have left. The next person is Jacob.
I do. And I was like,
hey, good evening, Glenn. How are you?
I'm good. Good.
Good. Glad to hear that. I actually had some more personal questions, if that's okay. And if it's not, then obviously, please feel free to shut me down. Number one, I was just wondering if you knew what your old pal Jeremy Scahill was up to these days. He's kind of been silent for the past couple of years. He hasn't been on his own podcast in like 2.5 years. And of the dozen times his bylines appeared in The Intercept in the last 13, 14 months, one of them was his statement on you. So I'm just curious to know, like, if you're in touch with him and if you know what he's up to and where he's been hiding.
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, you know, Jeremy is somebody who has spent, like, before we formed The Intercept, almost 20 years reporting from some of the most difficult war zones on the planet. And he, like, didn't do it in the way that, you know, like, CNN reporters did it, embedded with the U.S. military. He would, like, go deep into Afghanistan or Somalia or Pakistan, like, the parts that you were told you weren't supposed to go. He started off as, like, a young reporter in Serbia and in Kosovo, and has just been reporting on wars for 20 years, and that has taken a toll. So I think he, you know, with the support of many people, his colleagues and friends, including me, has tried to restructure his work so he didn't experience complete burnout. And The Intercept has kind of enabled him to do that. He's not reporting from war zones anymore. I think most of his time, I'm obviously not there. I haven't been there in a year or a little more than that. So I can't really speak to it, you know, since I haven't been there. But he does do that podcast. What's it called? Intercepted, I think. Intercepted. He does take off like 4 months during the summer, I believe. But for the other seven, eight months of the year, I think he's primarily focused on that podcast and hosting it.
Oh, I've been a subscriber to it since it launched, and he hasn't been on it in months. Like, not even as a guest on his own podcast.
Yeah, so, but I think during the summer he kind of takes off and is able to do because of the work he does with The Intercept. But like I said, I'm not there, so I don't want to speak to that.
Right, for sure. I was more just curious because I was always interested in his work, and I've just noticed it's been on a decline in the last couple of years in terms of the quantity. So that's interesting. Another thing I was wondering is what your views were on religion as an institution, because it's obviously a big driving force in society, but not one that you talk about a lot. So I was wondering, you know, what your thoughts are on religion, if you have one or have previously identified with one, and how you see religion shaping the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really deep and complex question. I didn't grow up with religion. I grew up, like, you know, in a secular Jewish family. I was in bar mitzvah. And then I lived in, you know, large American cities in Washington, D.C. and New York as a gay man. And so that's not really the path to religious awakening. And so I kind of, you know, probably had a fair amount of hostility, like political hostility toward organized religion. In the 80s and 90s, I represented this political movement. Could you just mute yourself, by the way, just because there's a lot of noise coming from. Yeah, thanks. So, you know, I think I had a lot of hostility just because in the 80s and 90s, when I came of age politically, religion for me meant Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and this kind of retrograde movement that was very much about policing people's personal lives and moralizing about them in a way that I found and still find quite pernicious. But as I've gotten older, my views of religion have become much more multifaceted. I think religion does a great amount of good in the world. You know, there's hospitals and research institutions and charities that are incredibly devoted to the real values of what the religion claims to be. In Latin America, we were talking earlier about the different ways that politics manifest. You know, Latin American leftism has been driven in large part by Catholics and by missionaries from around the world who come to Latin America to do work on behalf of the Catholic Church that manifests not in this like post, you know, Pope Benedict, Reagan, Thatcher, anti-communism kind of way, but in a way that is a certain form of leftism about giving comfort and nurture to the poor of the world, to the diseased of the world. And I think just ultimately what I've kind of come to the conclusion of is obviously religion can do a great deal of evil, but we all as human beings, I do believe, need some sort of spiritual connection to the world. It can take an endless number of forms how we obtain that. But I think religion is one way that people seek it. And I think ultimately people of different religions are all really seeking the same kind of human fulfillment that people who do meditation or Buddhism or any number of other spiritual activities that aren't quite as much connected to organized religion are also seeking. And so my animosity toward it is definitely diluted, and I see it in a lot more multifaceted way.
Thanks. That's a really thoughtful response. I was primarily asking because there's been a trend, particularly in some parts of the right, to call the far left a religion now and frame it in terms of being woke is a religion. And I just noticed it's not really framing that you've really used. So I was just wondering if there was anything behind that in terms of
I do think that what that gets to is I do think we all need purpose. I think we all crave being connected to you know, a cause or purpose greater than ourselves. And I think if we don't have that, we live this very selfish and ultimately unfulfilled life. And I do think that with the, you know, secularization of the West, a lot of people have started to use politics for that end, not just people on the left, but definitely people on the right. And I don't really think that's a healthy way to do politics. At the same time, sometimes politics can provide this kind of cause greater than yourself in a way that is fulfilling. So it so much depends on the specifics of it. But I don't like the wokeism as a religion framing, just because it kind of implies that there's something derogatory about religion, which I don't really share. All right, why don't we take one more? Did you want to add anything to that, Q? Did you want to comment on that, or do you want to take the next caller?
No, that was a you thing.
All right, great. The next person is James. Go ahead and unmute yourself.
Hi, Glenn, Q. Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Thank you guys for doing this. I just wanted to start there. I guess this question is mainly for Glenn, considering, Glenn, you were an attorney at some point. Is that right?
Yes, in days that I try and forget.
Okay, so how do you hold journalists accountable for, say, misleading the public in our constitutional system? I'm sure you've probably recently seen a broadcast TV network, who I won't name, if you want to, you can, recoloring Joe Rogan when he had COVID to make him look way worse than he was. I guess the real question here is, what's the incentive to be honest when the reward for lying and misleading is much higher? I guess, what keeps you honest?
Look, I mean, you know, this is the thing that I try and argue on the other side of the ledger, which is when people on the left come and say, well, you're against censorship, you're against banning of people from social media. Well, then what then is your solution to misinformation or people who are deliberately spreading disinformation? And my answer is, there may not be a solution. Sometimes there's a cost that we have to incur in order to have particular freedom. So I think it's really important that people who have public influence are subject to very robust criticism. So obviously, one way that media or, you know, organizations are held accountable is if they lie about somebody, they can be sued and have been sued, sometimes sued out of existence, the way Gawker was. And other media outlets have been, you know, hit with very big verdicts for lying about people. But I think the law pretty much gets it right, which is that if media outlets are speaking about private figures, about private matters, so somebody who's not in the public spotlight and you're talking about their personal life, the ease with which you can sue that media outlet for defamation is much, much greater than if you're talking about a public figure like Joe Rogan and you're talking about a matter of public interest, like his comments about COVID, for example. I do think media outlets need a lot more latitude to be able to speak freely and robustly without constantly fear being sued by people who have a lot of public influence. It shouldn't be absolute, and it's not absolute. The standard is actual malice. So if I speak about someone in the public spotlight, Joe Biden or Joe Rogan or whoever, and I say something wrong, but I'm trying to get it right, they can't sue me. But if I say something about them that I know is false and I'm doing it deliberately to hurt them or the reputation, then I can be sued because that's actual malice. So I think that's a pretty good standard, the way that the law balances the need to have some accountability for media outlets, but also the fact that it can't be absolute. And I get what you're saying. The media lies all the time and they seem to get away with it. And you're right, they do. But I think that's just the cost of having a free press, similar to disinformation being a cost to allowing people free speech.
Do you think that they try and play it to like an edge of where they're sitting there with their lawyers? Hey, you can say this, you can't say that. I mean, is there a line? Or
I'll tell you what the real line is, which is the richer you are, the more careful they are about what they say about you, which is a huge problem.
Right.
I have a friend who's a great journalist who spent 10, 15 years in Brazil. And he wrote a book about Brazilian billionaires called Brazilianaires.
Okay.
It was a very carefully researched book. He's a very scrupulous, meticulous journalist, Alex Quadras. And he could not get that book published in Portuguese. So Brazilians were unable to read it because publishers are petrified of having people with infinite pockets sue them, namely Brazilian billionaires. But if you wanted to write a book slamming ordinary people, you know, like the people at January 6th who don't have much money, it would be all signs ahead, you know, go do what you want. And that, I think, is the concern, is that media outlets are much more careful dealing with people who have more financial power, because those are the people who can inflict a lot more damage on them. And that, I think, is the problem.
So there's no real, in your view, there's no real fix to that. It's just, you know, really hoping that other people see it and hold that.
Well, and, you know, I think you see that there's a collapse in trust and faith from the part of the public.
Absolutely.
In major outlets. And I think that ultimately is the price. So you asked me before, what's my incentive to try and be honest? It's that I believe that I will lose my readership and the trust they have in me if I get caught lying. And that's the thing I value most.
Yeah. And that's, for example, that's why I value, you know, coming in here, and I'm sure why a lot of these other people are here, is because, you know, you want to get to the truth. And so, Glenn, thank you for that. I don't know if Q had anything he wanted to add, but thank you guys so much.
Hey, thank you. It was a great question. I really appreciate it. Do you want to take one more call, Q?
Oh, yeah, sure. We can go ahead. I was just going to say that, like, I don't think that journalists sit around, like, thinking of lies to tell. You know, it's not like two old men, you know, playing dominoes in the basement, just making up bigger and bigger lies to tell each other. I think more what it looks like is that there's a lot of people use the phrase conventional wisdom without knowing how it came about. Conventional wisdom is not like, hey, this is the thing that we believe. Conventional wisdom is, this is the truth that we've arrived at by basically listening to each other's bullshit, and we've just decided that it is the truth. So it becomes a true thing. That happens a lot in newsrooms, and it happens, as Glenn said, like, the richer you are and the more influence you have, then the things that you say just become commonly accepted knowledge.
Q, if I may, I mean, I'm not suggesting that people sit in their basements and try and do that, but I think what I'm saying is, you know, in a world where it's about clicks and views, I think that media outlets and publishers have an incentive in trying to figure out what's going to get the most clicks, maybe without necessarily caring what the legal, well, maybe not the legal implications, but without really caring what it's, the damage it's going to do to individuals, if that makes sense. And so they want to craft something that is going to sit with people and get views, get clicks.
Hey, listen, I just saw a New York Times article today that outed a man who had received a heart transplant from a pig, ran a story that he had stabbed somebody several years ago. Now, what relevance this has to whether he should have received a heart? Like, I'm not sure exactly what these two occurrences have to do with one another. One, he received a heart transplant from a pig, which was successful. And two, he stabbed somebody several years ago. I'm not sure what they have in common, but they mashed together that story and made it a highly clickable article. It's doing very well. I'm watching the traffic on it just, like, go through the roof. So, yeah, it is often that media will run, and even ostensibly, like, prestigious and serious publications will run absolute bullshit stories and run smear campaigns against people or even groups of people, states even, political people that don't align with their politics. Like, that does happen all the time. I think that's less out of malice and more so just, like, institutional stodginess. Like, you get into a particular publication, newsroom, organization, etc., and in order to fit in with all of the people who think the same way, or for people that can bring you up to where you want to be in your career, you shovel a little bit of shit, and then you find yourself at some point just being a professional shit shoveler. A really good example of this would be, I'm just going to go ahead and say it. Justin Ling, who used to write for Vice many years ago, still does occasionally, I think, but also right now writes for Maclean's, writes for the Globe and Mail in Canada, etc. One of the most diseased foreign policy minds in this fucking country. And at one point had, I think, very, I don't know if I would say correct, but, like, very, like, fresh takes on everything from, like, government to policing to how LGBT minorities are treated and so on. Like, he did a very good job with that, and then was ultimately brain poisoned by people who straddle the line between media and politics, especially people that do like comms and PR work, to the point now where essentially he is writing stenographic articles or writing like cribbed notes from the McDonald Laurier Institute, which is like a neoliberal think tank up here. So I don't think that Justin Lang started out that way. I think he got that way by being surrounded with the kind of people who had the kind of positions that he aspired to be at. And in order to get there, you have to say the same shit. And at some point, he started believing it.
Got it. Okay, well, thank you guys so much. I appreciate it, Glenn and Q. Thank you guys for the answers.
All right, thank you, James. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, let's take one more.
Yeah, let's take one more. It is, hold on one second. It is going to be BC, so let me just... Go ahead, BC. You can unmute yourself. I don't hear you.
Can't
Q,
hear
can you hear?
No, I can't hear anything.
We don't hear you. You do seem unmuted. I'm not.
If you want to sort out the sound problem, maybe like shoot one of us a message, and then when we come back next week, we'll bump you to the front of the queue because I don't want to penalize you for having some technical problems.
Yeah, if for our next show, which is going to be at the same time as always, Thursday, 4:30 p.m. Eastern, just come back and you can shoot us a message. And we'll
as
make
always,
sure
no, this is new. This is a new thing that we're doing now.
I know, but as always, going forward.
Okay.
All right, so instead of BC, we're going to end with Marge. Go ahead and unmute yourself, Marge.
Wow, am I really live?
You are really live.
This is so incredible. But I got to admit, I'm a little bit afraid with the government coming down on me for what I know. And so I'm just going to say that up front. And I asked my husband in the background to help me with details because there is so much going on that so many people don't know. And I'm just surprised at how many different organizations will take a topic and run it, not go back very far with the history of it, but not connect all the dots that have been connected, that I've been able to connect. And I find it hard to believe, just like looking at your show, 92 live callers, there has got to be more than that. There's got to be thousands of people that are interested. Where are they?
I mean, just on that, you know, this is a really new app. It's still not available for people who have Android. It will be shortly. So we're building, you know, an audience. Each time we do a show, the audience steadily grows. But it's a brand new app. I think it's like 2 months, 3 months old at most. And it's still only available to people with iPhones. So we expect there to be a lot more growth as we do it. It's still in kind of its beta phase as we're looking at it.
I just want to say once more for the record, because I've been saying this for a while. And I am very sympathetic towards Android developers. I believe that they should get hazard pay. But developing for iOS... people seem to have this impression that this show is on an iOS, right now an iOS exclusive device, because Colin wants to develop for iOS because of the prestige of being on the iOS or something like that. I don't know. But I'm being called an iOS bourgeois who is a traitor to the Android proletariat, to which I say, try fucking coding in Swift versus Java. It is a night and day experience. I hate Java. I refuse to fully learn the language. I will never, ever develop in Java. Swift, on the other hand, is incredibly easy to develop for. So that's why you'll see apps end up on iOS first before they get to Android. The development cycle for many Android, mass adopted apps, tends to be at least 3 to 6 months behind developing for iOS. So I'm going to play a little violin song for the Android developers that I know are slaving away in the development mines at the Colin head offices. I would like to know whether they're actually being fed and watered. I think it's actually like an important human rights issue to figure out if their Android developers are being allowed to see their families and if they get more than one call a day. Developing for Java fucking sucks.
Yeah, well, that's very empathetic. And I should also note that, you know, each one of our shows is saved and they develop very, very quickly a website that enables everybody, regardless of the type of phone you have, you don't even need a phone, actually, you just need an internet connection to be able to listen to the program. So how many people are in the rooms live as we record is a tiny, tiny fraction of the number of people who end up listening to the show. Right. But as I said, like, we're, you know, this app is at the very beginning of its development and has grown much more rapidly, actually, than I anticipated that it would, given how crowded the marketplace is. But I think people are seeing that it works well, and the interactivity it provides is pretty unique. So I expect it to continue to grow more rapidly still, and especially once it's enabled on Android. But did you have anything else you wanted to add, Marge? Because we're
okay. Just about over our time. I'm just going to shoot off a few things real quick. If you ever want to talk about them, the insurrection on January 6th, there was a video that came out that showed that lady being shot, Babbitt, how she faked the whole thing, how the whole thing was rehearsed, how the people are talking to each other. Okay, it's now you're supposed to do this. And there's this orchestration of how it all happened. And they even have footage when she came out and she was on the stretcher and she was supposed to be dead. She opens her eyes, and when they lift her up, it shows the blood pack around her waist that she used for the fake blood. They showed scenes of where the police were walking through the blood scene to smear it up more. They showed.
And stop. Just no. Come on now. No.
Okay, so none of that's true.
No, that lady died. The police put her in a spliff. That actually happened.
She was cremated, but so what I saw didn't happen.
Yeah, so they put her in a spliff. No. She was shot and she was killed.
You actually
I really don't go in for this crisis actor stuff because there is so much bullshit happening right in front of our faces.
Okay, so I'm going to leave it there.
Brazenly, that our governments admit to openly, there's so much of that available that we ought to, I think, be more upset and more indignant and vigilant about without having to make up stuff.
It was okay. That's where I'm going to leave it. And right. This is part of the scenario I'm talking about. Okay. If you just want to talk about the vaccines, the history of the vaccines, where the initial viruses came from, who put the patents on the vaccines? Who put the patents on the actual virus? When it was created, the viruses are created. They put a patent on it. Then several years later, they do a vaccine on it, and they put a patent on that. And the current situation with like Fauci, how the government is in connected with the pharmaceutical industry in profits, and how there's videos of Dr. So-and-so, I'm not going to say his name again, is in a group with there's also like with things with Bill Gates, you know, how are we going? Gosh, didn't say that. How they were going to, they needed to get more people vaccinated. So they needed to create a fear campaign. So they needed to come up with, a virus that was multifaceted as far as being able to do as much fear tactics to destroy the governments around the world so they could come in and take control. I mean, this whole thing is nefarious.
Let me just jump in there. You know, I think we've done a lot of shows on COVID, and we definitely questioned the financial incentives of these pharmaceutical companies and even governments to make certain claims. But I think, you know, one of the problems that I think we have is that there's a lot of information that is still not disclosed about the entire pandemic. And that's what leads to this kind of breach where people start speculating about, you know, what the real causes of it are, or what really was behind it. And I think we're going to learn a lot more as these investigations continue. So on that note, thank you so much to everybody who both came and stayed. We almost went for 2 hours. The questions were really great, which always makes the discussion of the podcast even better. So we're really grateful for the people who wait in line and who ask questions. If you were in the queue, there were a couple people who didn't get a chance. Please come back next week. I do my show. Q does his show. We do our show together. Our new time is Thursday, 4:30 p.m. And Q, I will see you next week.
Yep. See you next week.
All right. Goodbye, everybody. Thanks.